Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Very pleased to be back with you in the new year. Yep, it's 2019. Coming up on today's program, we'll do some stargazing in the heavens above and here on Earth. And later in the program, we've got some political news at the state level. But since we're still in the holiday spirit, let's get to some fun stuff first. Ohio's oldest modern dance company is celebrating its 50th season. That's right, the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company, affectionately known as DCDC, has nurtured generations of dancers. Community Voices producer Jocelyn Robinson introduces us to the family at the heart of the company.
Back in October, the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company opened its 50th season with a world premiere of a full-length ballet. The Bench, A Journey into Love, was all about family. It told the story of a pair of lovers and their three children through movement, voice, and an original jazz score. Choreographer Keisha LaLama rehearsed the dancers and singers in a sequence where the mother offers her two daughters wisdom before the elder one marries. The three dancers manipulate a voluminous skirt of flowing fabric, swooping and dipping, ducking under and through the bright material as it fills with air like a sail. DCDC itself is all about passing gifts from one generation to the next. Founder Geraldine Blunden's daughter, Debbie Blunden Diggs, is the company's third artistic director, behind her mother and Kevin Ward, who took the helm after Geraldine's death in 1999. Debbie's been with the company since she was 12 years old. When she graduated from high school, she had a choice to make.
I decided to continue to dance, and actually it was quite interesting. My mother was opposed to it. My mother said, no, you should probably, and my father's like, no, if this is her dream, then we need to support it. And so I've been here ever since.
Now there's a third generation following the pathway first blazed by Geraldine Blunden. One of Debbie's two daughters is taking a year off from college and dancing with DCDC2, the pre-professional company.
And so now we have Alexis. It's really tough for her. It's, on some days you don't want anybody to know that you're related to me or Geraldine. And some days you are in the glow of what it means to be a part of that family and a part of that legacy.
But Debbie and Alexis aren't the only ones to grow up in the DCDC family.
But everyone calls me Sparkle, so I go by Sherry Sparkle Williams. And this is my 45th season with the Dayton Contemporary Dance Company now. And let's see, as the oldest and longest sustained member of the company, I am a dancer, first and foremost, but also a mom, and I say that, lovingly, endearingly about the other dancers.
Sparkle is one of 13 dancers in the first company. She's DCDC's fitness trainer, and every dancer's day begins with her morning class. Devin Baker is a veteran dancer who's been with the company for five seasons, performing the role of the father in the Bench. Devin knows firsthand why dancers form such close relationships.
You know, we come from all over, and these dancers are my friends, they're my family. If something was to go wrong, one of them would know, and they would have to translate that back to my family. Like, we are all we have in a sense.
I'm a new member to the family, yes, but they definitely have welcomed me with open arms.
That's Columbus native Alexandria Fluellen. At 22, she's just earned her BFA in dance from Wright State University.
I came through the company through DCDC2, the second company, and working my way up is the same amount of push and drive for you to be a better dancer and a better artist, and that's the love that's given every day.
It all goes back to the vision of the founder. Back to the legacy Geraldine Blunden passed on to her daughter and to the entire DCDC family.
Well, I think her legacy is much bigger and much broader than dance. Her legacy is of love and nurturing and allowing you a place to put your best foot forward, a place that allows you to stand even when your best foot is not forward. I always tell people I can show you better than I can tell you who we are and what we do, but it is very special. It's extremely special.
The Dayton Contemporary Dance Company's 50th season celebration will continue through the spring of 2019. You can learn more about DCDC's upcoming performances and special anniversary events at dcdc.org. For Culture Couch at WYSO, I'm Jocelyn Robinson.
Well, from the Earth to the Moon to the stars, we continue our cultural update with a look at how we view the heavens above. The Mars InSight lander has been sending outstanding images of the red planet back to Earth. Mars was visible with the naked eye for much of December, but if you used a telescope, you could see even more of the planet and other celestial objects. Experienced stargazers know what a miraculous and highly technical instrument the telescope is. In this segment, Community Voices producer Jim Cale tells us about a man from Southwest Ohio who makes telescopes, and he's traveled to the rural countryside near the tiny town of Philo, Illinois, to meet him.
I've been driving the last few hours on narrow roads through vast fields of corn and soy to talk with Mike Lockwood of Lockwood Optical. In the wide open and dark spaces, Lockwood Optical produces incredibly fine mirrors with near impossible accuracy, the heart of a great telescope.
Interest in astronomy came from living in the middle of pitch black nowhere because you can't help but look up at the sky and, you know, watch the northern lights occasionally. And if you live under that and you don't get interested, then something's wrong.
Maybe we should start by explaining on a very basic level how these telescopes work, what the optics actually do.
Okay, so the light comes down from the sky. There's a parabolic primary mirror that is at the bottom of the telescope that collects the light. The light bounces off the concave primary mirror, goes up, hits the flat secondary, and is reflected out into an eyepiece, which is in a focuser where you view the image.
After completing his master's degree, Mike was doing research when he revisited his old telescope project he started in middle school. He found the original mirror and finished it. Then he began making and fixing mirrors for friends and colleagues as a hobby.
And eventually, one of my friends brought over a so-called professional mirror. And that was an epiphany, because it was a piece of crap. And I said, I can do better than this. I could do better, and then I did better. And I continued to fix some, I continued to make some new ones. Eventually, I had a small side business going while I was still doing research at the university.
So unless we want a funhouse view of the universe, our measurements for the mirror have to be very accurate. How close to perfect do they need to be?
These mirrors have a surface accuracy on the order of a few millionths of an inch of error if they're made right. These are the most precise surfaces made in the world. If you blew up a mirror to the size of the United States, the errors would be on the order of a few inches tall. So you have to use techniques that are gentle and then measure with accuracy. That's where a lot of the art comes in. Very systematically track down all the sources of error. I mean, things as simple as measuring on a concrete floor and not a wood floor, because the wood floor can change dimensions while you're testing.
I can't help but think that this has got to be a setup for great frustration.
I have thrown things. It happens.
So given all the difficulties and the frustration involved with this kind of work, why do you do it?
It's just a good match. I get to do a little bit of math every now and then and think about things scientifically, but I also get to start a project and finish a project and deliver it. And there's a satisfaction in that.
Mike's mirrors help feed the passions of astronomers all over the world. I visited the Warren Rupp Observatory in Belleville, Ohio, home to a 36-inch Lockwood Optics mirror housed in a 19-foot-tall telescope named Big Blue. As it turned out, the skies were cloudy and I didn't get to look through Big Blue this time. But I did get a sense of the passion and wonder of astronomy while talking with longtime volunteer and stargazer Dan Everett.
If you only had one more opportunity, what would you look for?
I'd probably go to the Great Nebula in Hercules. I've made people cry showing them this globular cluster because it just looks like diamonds dumped on black velvet. It'll just take your breath away. It's just beyond comprehension. People have asked me over the years, what's the best thing you've ever seen in the sky? And I said, It isn't so much the sky, but when you see a young person's eye go to the eyepiece and you see that beam of light come out and hit their eye and you hear them go, that's the thrill. That's the real thrill, you know. The sky is a glorious thing, and most people don't spend enough time looking up.
For Culture Couch on WYSO, this is Jim Cale.
Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. Now, moving from the stars above to a potential future star here on Earth. We hope to someday say we knew her when. Here's Dayton Youth Radio Project Coordinator Basim Blunt to introduce us to an aspiring young filmmaker.
There are not many students who plan to be filmmakers, but seeing the wide view is important, and that's what this young woman is good at.
My name's Jadon, and I'm a senior at Ponant CTC. My goal in life is to entertain people with movies. I grew up watching a lot of movies at home with my three older brothers and, of course, my parents. It's actually better to watch movies at home because it can be paused and you can interpret what's going on better. Even though none of my family is as interested in the entertainment industry like me, they still support my writing. My favorite genres are science fiction and fantasy. I get so involved in movies that I binge-watch movies over the weekends. A lot of people don't know that there aren't a lot of women directors in the film industry. People can list male directors like Steven Spielberg, Quentin Tarantino, and Spike Lee without even thinking about it. How many female directors can you list on both your hands?
One day over the summer, I was kind of bored, so I decided to research, and I came across this article, and it talked about how there aren't that many women in the film industry. And I was honestly pretty shocked about this because as many movies as I watch it, I wasn't even aware of this information. Only one woman has won an award for winning Best Movie Director. That woman was Kathryn Bigelow. Finding this out made me feel disappointed. Out of all the movies made in America, only one woman in the country won for Best Film Director? Knowing this about the film industry makes me feel very sad. It makes me question things like, how is this possible? Why aren't women getting recognized? What does that say about this field? Kathryn Bigelow once said, if there's a specific resistance to women making movies, I just choose to ignore that as an obstacle for two reasons. I can't change my gender, and I refuse to stop making movies. After high school, I plan on going to college to study film and creative writing. Those are two things that I'm very passionate about. My top three colleges to study film are Wright State, Baldwin-Wallace, and Taylor University. I'll be happy with these three colleges because they all provide really good film programs. I want to learn everything there is to know about filmmaking. My first official movie would be one of my stories. It's about identical twin boys named Demetrius and Dominic. Dominic dies in the womb and Demetrius survives. Ever since being in the womb, Demetrius has the ability to talk to his brother telepathically and see him. The movie would be called The Supernatural Twins because their powers are beyond human understanding. Women deserve equal recognition. When you have a dream, you shouldn't let anyone tell you or make you feel like you're not good enough. You have the power to make a difference. For Dayton Youth Radio at Ponant CTC, this is Jadon.
That was Waiting for My Close-Up, written and produced by Jadon Wilson, a senior at Ponant's Career Technology Center. Special thanks to Joanne Visca and Jeffrey Crowell. To hear more stories from this series, visit WYSO.org or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO.
These are the final days of the John Kasich gubernatorial era, and over the years, his tone has changed dramatically as he's worked to accomplish his goals and raise his national profile. State House correspondent Karen Kassler has this retrospective on Kasich's 8 years as Ohio's governor.
Kasich launched his campaign in his adopted hometown of Westerville in June 2009 with this message.
We march over time to destroy that income tax that has sucked the vitality out of this state.
Coming into his first election for governor, Kasich was confident, brash, and apparently irritated, as evident in this interview after a speech in Findlay in October 2010.
I wouldn't presume to guess my economic program. Okay, you'll know about it when I put it out.
A few weeks later, he won, but his start was rocky. This audio from a talk with lobbyists came out a few days after he was elected.
Because we need you on the bus, and if you're not on the bus, we will run over you with the bus. And I'm not kidding.
Then a few weeks after he took office, there was this in a speech to state EPA workers.
Have you ever been stopped by a policeman who was an idiot?
That and Kasich's comment that he was waiting for teachers' unions to take out full-page ads apologizing for what they said about him during the campaign went over especially poorly when the Republican-dominated legislature passed Senate Bill 5. Kasich supported that public sector collective bargaining reform law that unions furiously fought, including during his State of the State speech in March 2011.
And frankly, folks, the provisions of collective bargaining reform are examples of what we wanted to do to allow people.
That was the only State of the State address Kasich delivered at the State House. He took the joint session speech to Steubenville, Lima, Medina, Wilmington, Marietta, Sandusky, and then finally to Westerville. Those speeches have gotten mixed reviews. Most were longer than an hour, and few included new policies or ideas. And lawmakers began to complain about travel. Senate Bill 5 was overwhelmingly defeated by voters in Kasich's first year. Kasich was contrite in defeat and never again said he'd back so-called right-to-work legislation. He turned then to leasing the Ohio Turnpike and increasing the tax on oil and gas fracking. Those ideas failed, but he pushed Medicaid expansion through a state legislative panel against intra-party critics with some strong religious-themed language.
When you die and get to the meeting with St. Peter, he's probably not going to ask you much about what you did about keeping government small, but he's going to ask you what you did for the poor. You better have a good answer.
In spite of Republican opposition to his Medicaid expansion, Kasich easily won his job again in 2014 over a scandal-hobbled Democratic candidate, riding a wave of popularity that propelled him to something he told me a few weeks before his reelection he wasn't thinking about.
I don't figure I'm moving out of Ohio. I'm expecting. That's why I'm running for governor.
But don't you have presidential aspirations? I know you did once.
Well, I did. You know, and that didn't work out so well, or I wouldn't be here doing this interview.
Kasich launched his second presidential campaign 9 months later and won only the Ohio primary. He suspended it in May 2016, taking no questions from dozens of reporters at the announcement. Kasich has had a tumultuous relationship with the media. He said early on that he didn't read Ohio newspapers, and he often avoided gaggles and sit-downs with State House reporters. But by his last year, he was praising the press and was a regular on the national cable news shows, though he is still critical, as he was of a Columbus Dispatch report on jobs growth in March.
Yeah, well, their numbers are wrong, so fake news.
He later apologized. Kasich says he's still considering challenging President Trump in 2020, a decision he'll have to make soon. But he told me if he does, he'd want to as a Republican, because he's not a moderate.
I don't even know what that means. I'm a conservative, but my principles are in line with conservatism.
But not necessarily on guns. Kasich had been endorsed by the NRA and signed several pieces of gun rights legislation. But after the shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida last February, a section of Kasich's website changed from defending the Second Amendment to common sense on the Second Amendment, as he was on CNN, calling on lawmakers to take some steps on gun control. While Kasich vetoed the last gun bill he got, lawmakers overrode that, and his proposals went nowhere. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
And the transition to the administration of Governor-elect Mike DeWine is bringing several changes to state government, including a new office dedicated to carrying out one of DeWine's top campaign promises. State House correspondent Andy Chow reports.
As part of his first major policy rollout, DeWine announced his plan to help Ohio's children. That plan detailed a focus on providing early childhood education and intervention programs. As part of his first cabinet announcements, DeWine appointed Leanne Cornian to lead the newly created Office of Children Initiatives. Cornian says there's already a good infrastructure in state government to help children in Ohio, split among several departments. So her office will help streamline the communication between those agencies.
But I think this is really just to harness the energy and all of the work that is going on across different state agencies and work on driving that all of those efforts to make sure that they're aligned, that they're efficient, that we're all talking across our different systems.
Cornian says the DeWine administration has five pillars to focus on for young children: to increase newborn home visits, early childhood education, access to mental health professionals in schools, foster care, and drug abuse prevention education. Cornian says home visits and early childhood education can provide crucial intervention for a child who might be behind in behavioral, social, academic, and physical development.
These interventions are really critical for kids really, really early on. We're talking about 0 to 3. So before these children even touch any other agency or system, we're really trying to identify these children, identify these families super early, and surge in some resources that help mitigate problems on the back end that many of our school districts are inheriting.
The new Office of Children Initiatives is exciting news to former State Senator Shannon Jones and her advocacy group, Groundwork Ohio.
The biggest challenge facing Ohio's youngest and most vulnerable children is that they don't vote, they don't have super PACs, and the types of interventions that we know can help them be productive citizens aren't inexpensive.
Jones says preparing children for kindergarten can have long-term positive outcomes.
In Ohio, only 40% of our children are entering kindergarten ready to learn. So it really shouldn't be surprising us that 43% of our adults today have a degree or credential that leads to an actual job. So we need to follow the science. We need to follow the research.
Expanding these programs can come with a high price tag. For example, fewer than 4% of eligible families are served with home visitations through $20 million in current funding. DeWine wants to triple the number of families served to 12%. Democratic Representative Tavia Galansky of Akron is also optimistic about the focus on helping children, but she says it comes down to how much money the state is willing to invest in these programs.
Someone comes up with a funding scheme that actually, you know, is only a drop in the bucket for the problem in order to repair the problem. And so what I will be looking at very specifically is, what have children's services organizations asked for? What type of funding have they already asked for, not received? And then we're talking about how can you fund additional programming?
Jones agrees that DeWine's upcoming budget will be an indication of how serious he takes this issue. However, she says success of the programs will have to be measured down the line through things like kindergarten preparedness and third grade reading. Cornian, as with Jones and Galansky, adds that helping children can have multiple benefits.
So this is critical from an economic perspective, from a workforce development perspective, and from a moral perspective, just making sure that these kids are able to live up to their full potential.
Cornian says many studies have looked into the return on investment for programs that help kids. She says some researchers say states can see as much as $14 for every $1 spent. Andy Chow at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of deep winter and the first full week of the squashy Osage moon and the third week of the sun in Capricorn. The last Christmas cacti are blossoming near my greenhouse windows, safe from the wind on the other side. My winter tomatoes hold without moving to their trellises. The red and pink and white geraniums brought in from the autumn bloom and then fall and then bloom again. I have a journal of the greenhouse as well as of the outside cycles, and I keep a planting and nature log, and I carefully measure the natural progress of the year. But now I'm losing interest in the records of that progress like I do every winter, and I'm turning to plants that change the least. I want things to stay the way they are. I don't really care, I guess, if spring equinox comes, because I'm comfortable with the limits of winter right now. I'm content with the finite number of species that hide with me from the cold. I know this static world better than I will ever know the new emerging world. And since the end of October, I've kept the season stable and warm, and even the white flies and the mealybugs have contributed to equilibrium, their hunger offsetting growth. At night, I stand together with the plants around me. I identify with them and hide with them behind this glass wall. And I feel our alliance and our common purpose. No April birds are singing, and there are no fireflies or crickets to mark the passage of the year and of my life, and no signs that any of this could ever end. This is Bill Felker with Pourville's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of deep winter, and the second week of the squashy Osage fruit moon. In the meantime, hunker down inside your cave, suspended from the passage of time.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. Additional support for WYSO Weekend comes from Urban Handmade in Yellow Springs, featuring unique holiday gifts and apparel from independent makers, including Yellow Springs t-shirts, adult cross-stitch, and furniture made from skateboards. More at shopurbanhandmade.com. Urban Handmade, the revolution will not be mass-produced. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Until then, take care. Coming up next on Why So, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.
This is Cindy Funk, and I hope you'll tune in to the Dear Green Place this Sunday. I'll have lots of great Celtic music for you, new, just-released music, and some with a bit of age on it that just makes it sweeter. Toes will be tapping the Dear Green Place Sunday at 1 p.m. on WYSO.